Horrific events in the Washington, D.C. area this morning when a gunman opened fire at a GOP congressional baseball practice. Here's Representative Rodney Davis on CNN this morning. He was at bat when the shooting began.
And I think Republicans and Democrats need to use this day today to stand together and say, stop. We can have our differences, but let's not let it lead to such hate.
We'll bring you the latest. Later, what happens when parents have trouble paying their child's school lunch bill? Some schools take drastic action, like throwing away the kids' hot lunch and giving them a cheese sandwich instead. It's become known as lunch shaming. We're going to take a look at this issue. Also, this week, 50 years ago, the Supreme Court legalized interracial marriage across the country with the landmark Loving versus Virginia case. Today, we talked to a Northwestern University law professor about what this means today. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As you've been hearing all morning on this NPR station, a gunman opened fire at a GOP congressional baseball practice in Virginia early this morning with five people shot, including House Majority Whip Steve Scalise. His office says he's in stable condition. He just got through surgery, according to House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, and says Scalise is doing well. They were practicing for the annual bipartisan congressional charity baseball game, which is still taking place tomorrow at National Park. They'll be playing for victims and officers. From our Illinois delegation, Representative Rodney Davis, who plays catcher for the GOP, was at bat when the shooting happened. He eventually took shelter in a nearby apartment. He described the scene this morning on CNN.
Was batting. We heard a loud noise, felt like a construction site. Somebody dropped a big piece of metal. And then the next thing I remember is somebody on the field yelling, run, he's got a gun. I ran into the dugout like most people on the field, and then eventually worked my way out of the dugout to other cover and dispersed. And I got to witness the heroism of the Capitol Police that were there as part of Steve Scalise's detail. If they wouldn't have been there, this would have been a massacre of innocent people.
The alleged shooter has been identified as James T. Hodgkinson from Belleville, Illinois. Belleville's just east of St. Louis. President Trump said a few moments ago that the shooter has died from his injuries. From a Facebook page that's listed to a James T. Hodgkinson from Belleville, there are posts that call President Trump a, quote, traitor who has, quote, destroyed our democracy. It says, quote, it's time to destroy Trump and company. He's also a part of Facebook groups, including one called Terminate the Republican Party. Representative Rodney Davis said today on CNN that the hateful rhetoric in our country has to stop and that today Democrats and Republicans need to stand together.
I believe that there's such a hatefulness in what we see in American politics and policy discussions right now. This has got to stop. Let's work together. Let's get things done. We can have our differences, but let's not let it lead to such hate.
We've seen so far from our Illinois delegation bipartisan expressions of support. Lots of tweets expressing horror, thoughts and prayers for those who were injured. Lots of expressions of support as well from both parties for the Capitol Police and how they handled the situation. Here on the 21st, our staff has compiled a web post of all of the tweets and statements. It's on our website, and we're tweeting it out now. Representative Rodney Davis described today's events as America's breaking point and his own when it comes to hateful political rhetoric.
It's my breaking point. That's why I'm here talking to you today. We've got to end this. We've got to stop it. And I never thought I'd play a baseball game for charity, go to practice at 6:30 in the morning, and have to dodge bullets.
Stay tuned to this NPR station throughout the day as the story continues to develop. When a child receives a hot lunch at school, it's reasonable for them to expect to actually get to eat it. But when some kids reach the cashier and find they don't have the money or that their parents haven't paid the full lunch bill to the district, whether it's a paperwork mix-up or an inability to pay, that child's hot lunch could get thrown into trash. In fact, in Alabama, one student was also stamped on the arm with the words, "I need lunch money." According to the New York Times, some school children have to clean tables in front of their classmates to pay off their lunch debt. All of this has become known as lunch shaming, calling out school children in some public way for not having paid their lunch bill. Some community leaders are starting to take action. New Mexico recently banned lunch shaming entirely. The USDA has set a July 1 deadline for all schools to write clear policies on unpaid meal debt and communicate that to parents. We wanted to get a sense today of what this looks like in Illinois and what's being done to make sure children have enough to eat at schools. Joining us now in our Urbana studios is Donald Owen. He's superintendent of Urbana School District 116. Superintendent, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Also on the line from Chicago is Amanda Critt. She's a child nutrition coordinator with the Illinois Hunger Coalition. Amanda, thank you for taking the time to be with us as well.
Thank you.
Amanda, according to a USDA study from 2014, nearly half of school districts use some kind of public method to get parents to pay lunch bills. 45% of them end up giving children a cold sandwich instead of a hot lunch. I wanted to ask you, how does this work? I mean, how do we get from parents not being able to or not paying school lunches, whether they just don't do it or they can't afford to? How do we get from there to children cleaning lunch tables or getting to this sort of public shaming part on behalf of the child if their parents can't pay?
Right. Well, I think that the big issue here is that, I guess, when parents aren't paying or they can't pay and and this is happening over and over again, when you hear it from one student, you think, I guess, the school should be able to absorb that one cost. But schools are seeing this happen a lot, actually. And when that happens over and over again, the cost does become too large for the school to absorb. So that's kind of why we're seeing it happen, I guess. And when schools can't absorb that large cost, there has to be some other method of dealing with it. Obviously, the problem here is that their method of dealing with it is often taken out on the student and not necessarily focused on the fact that it's the parent who owes the money, or there's some other way that money has to be made up. So a lot of times where we are seeing it being taken out on the actual student, and that's where this problem lies. So the giving them a cheese sandwich, making them do some sort of chore to do it, which is crazy, that's where this is playing out.
Superintendent Owen, I wonder if we could have you weigh in here. What you all have decided to do with Urbana School District 116 is something entirely different. Can you explain how you all have first how you handle this issue?
Sure. So 2 years ago, we looked into something called the community eligibility provisions from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And it's basically a way for school districts to apply for credit and get reimbursed for students' meals regardless of student income. And so one of the things that was attractive about that is it takes away, one, the possibility of family debt, because the families are no longer on the hook for the cost of their meals or a partial cost of their meals if they were on what was called reduced lunch. And two, it also eliminates the kind of visible system that was in place before where, students did have to identify. Some students were paying and some students were punching in a number and some students were showing a card. That's completely eliminated. And so it basically wipes out one of the most visible ways of social class identification in the schools. And it's been a huge benefit to our schools because we have more students participating in lunch, which means we get even larger reimbursements from the USDA. And that in turn means that we can provide more variety in our menus. And that in turn means more students will eat. So it's a nice cycle where we've seen a large increase in student participation in breakfast and lunch in our schools. And that allows us to provide more variety and better options for the students. And then we have more students participating even more.
Superintendent Owen, prior to you joining the community eligibility program, the CEP provision, program or its community eligibility provision. Sorry about that. How much did lunch cost?
So roughly lunch was about what ranged over time. But while I've been superintendent, it's ranged from about $1.75 to $2 if you're paying full price.
And how much is was the reduced price before?
Reduced price was a little bit less than half of that. So I believe reduced price was 85 cents. And so it's let me give you an example of a parent I talked to last year, our first year of the community eligibility, who had four students in the schools, and they qualified for reduced lunch. And they said, you know, our students eat breakfast and lunch every day at school, and they are paying, you know, a portion of that cost themselves. And when we moved to community eligibility, this parent had calculated over $1,300 coming back into their pockets that they could then use on other things like food at home or college savings or other activities for their children. And so that to me speaks loudly of why this is important, not just for students who are on the lowest end of our income scale for their families, but also across the board, because that money can go back into the family budget and provide other resources for the students.
Amanda, as we're hearing Superintendent Owen talk about Urbana and his district that rolling in the CEP program, I know this is something CPS did back in 2014, again, because they looked at the numbers. And I believe, as Superintendent Owen is saying, in Urbana, it ended up saving Chicago Public Schools quite a bit of money to also transition to just eliminating the system entirely and the payment systems and all of that and having everyone eligible. Why do not all districts choose this program, Amanda? Is it just because they don't have a threshold of enough students who qualify?
Sure. So you're right. We're actually at around 58% of eligible schools in Illinois are adopting the program. So a little over half of our schools who are eligible are doing it, which is great. Like the superintendent said, it really does save schools money. It eliminates the need to identify with income status. But we are seeing schools that usually it's because if the entire district itself isn't eligible for this program, that's kind of a hardship for applying for it. Because if a parent has a child in one school and a child in another school, and one of those schools qualifies, say like an elementary school qualifies and a high school doesn't, kind of having to deal with that discrepancy in schools is a problem sometimes for districts. So that's really the biggest reason why schools wouldn't necessarily do it. The other thing is, so schools with 40% or higher free and reduced lunch eligibility are eligible for the program. But the reimbursement is based off of it's a calculation based off of the percentage of the school. So if you're on that kind of 40%, the reimbursement isn't that high. It doesn't cover 100% of your meals. So there is a little bit of cost that the school would then have to absorb. So those are kind of the two reasons why we see schools that might not necessarily want to adopt it, even though it is definitely a beneficial program once you're in it.
And Superintendent Owen, how did you all make that calculation? Because, of course, all of this, it sounds really complicated. I imagine there isn't much about school and federal funding that is an easy process. But how did you all figure out that the financial side of it first?
Yeah, so that's actually Amanda has a very good point that first, are you eligible because of that minimum threshold of 40% receiving free and reduced lunch? And in Urbana School District as a whole, we've been at around 70% for the last several years. And so we were definitely above that threshold. But then there is a requirement of actually having data collected on how many students are participating at each level. So how many students are participating in breakfast and lunch at the free level, how many students are participating at the reduced level, and how many students are participating at the paid level. And you actually have to document that over time and submit that as part of your application process. And so I think that that probably is another hindrance to schools. But for us, there was, we did take a financial risk because we were looking at this and saying, when we had all of the numbers laid out, if we moved to CEP and we didn't have a 3-5% increase in our participation rates, we potentially could have been asked to absorb about $45,000 in costs. Well, as I said, our participation rate in breakfast went up by almost 20%, and our participation rate in lunch went up by almost 10% in our first semester of adoption. And so it paid for itself very easily. But I do think that that initial data collection is a little bit overwhelming for some school districts if they're not looking at the bigger picture. And for us, it really was an issue of, is this the right thing to do for students and families? And that, when you answer that as a yes, then you kind of say, well, let's then remove the barriers for us to do what's right.
Right. Amanda, I imagine with the Illinois Hunger Coalition, part of your job is to help school districts. Do you all do some of that work helping school districts with this issue?
Yes. Yeah, so as the child nutrition coordinator, I help schools. I can provide technical assistance with that. I have been reaching out to schools who do qualify for the program and would financially benefit from it. The deadline for applying is coming up, so it's June 30th. So right now
You know what, Amanda, I'm going to stop you there because we're going to have to take a break. We're going to continue this conversation on the other side of this. If everyone can hold on for just a couple of minutes while we take a break, we'll continue this conversation with Amanda Critt and Donald Owen about school lunches and the children who need them. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, supporting librarianship and the training of librarians, instructing instructors as they embed the library into classrooms and beyond the campus across the globe. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking right now about school lunches, about school lunch shaming. Of course, we're mindful of the events happening in Washington, D.C. We're continuing to monitor that as well. Stay tuned. We'll have some updates on that in a few minutes. The shooting this morning at the GOP congressional baseball practice. We're talking about school lunch right now because we're talking about the issue of lunch shaming. That's when parents haven't or aren't able to pay their school lunch bill. And what happens to their school children when the parents can't pay? On the line with me from Chicago is Amanda Critt. She's a child nutrition coordinator with the Illinois Hunger Coalition. In studio with us in our Urbana studios is Donald Owen. He's superintendent of Urbana School District 116. Amanda, just before the break, you were talking about how you work with school districts to get them enrolled into some programs. You said that about half of the schools in Illinois that are eligible are not applying for these programs?
Right. So the data we have is actually from school year 2015-16. And at that point, 58% of eligible schools had adopted the community eligibility provision, which makes school meals free for all of the students. If they have an income level that's at a certain threshold. So we at the Hunger Coalition with the State Board of Education have been trying to work with schools to try to get our state to that 100% because it is, like Donald said, a really great program for schools, not just so that it does bring in extra income for the schools, but it does kind of get rid of the idea of lunch shaming in general. So the deadline for that is June 30th. And we are trying to work with schools, help them with that technical assistance, get the paperwork in so that they can take advantage of it.
Amanda, what are the stories you've heard from families? We started this conversation talking about places like in Alabama with students stamped on the arm with the words, "I need lunch money." Are things like that happening here in Illinois?
They are, and they have actually been for a while. So this is a really important issue. And we run a statewide hunger hotline here at the Hunger Coalition. And we, a few years ago, actually, even before this lunch shaming was given its name, lunch shaming, got a call on the hotline from a parent whose child, it was actually an 8-year-old daughter, was at school and didn't have money on her account to pay for her lunch. So she went through her lunch line, she picked up her hot meal, and when she went to check out, the lunch lady actually took away her lunch. So it was thrown away. And she was so upset by this, she went outside of the school building to kind of gather herself, cry a little bit, and gather herself, really. And when she went back to enter the school, the doors were actually locked. So she was locked out of school, and the principal found her outside and punished her for leaving the school building, even though obviously there were these other circumstances. But she was punished from this. And then she went home, and when her mom was putting her to bed, they were praying, and she started crying and just was saying that she was a bad girl, she did something bad, and that she shouldn't pray, like she didn't deserve it. And this all really went back to the fact that her lunch was thrown away. So it really shows that kids don't understand the actual reasoning behind their meal being taken away. They don't know that it's these other circumstances, that maybe their account was low, they didn't have these paperworks turned in. And it really is something that's internalized and not understood from the kid's standpoint, which is why it's really important to take away the blame of this on the child, to really focus on how do you get that money back from the parents, from doing CEP, the other methods.
Superintendent Owen, did you have stories like that in Urbana? I wonder, is that what led you to abolishing the system entirely?
I hope we didn't have stories like that, but I do know that it was a struggle and a hardship on parents when we were trying to collect overdue lunch fees. And while we didn't, you know, take food out of children's hands, we did have a system set up where parents would get reminder calls that they needed to put more money on their children's accounts. And I know that that kind of constant reminder just adds stress to a family's life. And, you know, again, as I said, the example that Amanda gave is one that I really hope didn't happen in any of the schools in this area. But it's a sad testament of the way some things do play out. And the students are the ones that are, you know, most impacted by that.
Right. And Superintendent, I wonder what advice you would have for other districts about this issue now that you all have gone to the system where this isn't something that would happen.
Well, so two things. One is I would urge the districts that haven't applied for the CEP program that are eligible to take a serious look at it and look at not just the financial benefits, because for some districts it will be questionable. It'll be right on the fence as to whether or not it will provide a financial incentive. But instead, look at the issues of kind of justice and responsibility. I mean, the evidence says that students should be eating a healthy meal 3 times a day. And if schools can provide that twice a day, that's going to help students learn. That's going to help students stay focused. And if schools can do more to reduce the marginalization of students and families, my guess is that that will increase family engagement in the schools and in their students' educational process.
Well, thanks for joining us. That's Superintendent Donald Owen explaining how they've dealt with this at Urbana School District 116. I want to thank Amanda Critt as well. She's the Child Nutrition Coordinator with the Illinois Hunger Coalition, talking to us about this issue. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Richard and Mildred Loving just wanted a regular married life when they fell in love more than 50 years ago. But Richard was white, Mildred was black, and interracial marriage was illegal in the state of Virginia where they live. So they traveled to Washington, D.C. to tie the knot. And when they moved back to Virginia, local authorities arrested them. That was the start of a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court. 50 years ago this week, the High Court's ruling of Loving versus Virginia struck down state laws that criminalized interracial marriage. I'm joined now by our studios here in downtown Chicago at the Medill Graduate School of Journalism, Northwestern University, by Destiny Perry. She's an assistant professor also at Northwestern University at its Pritzker School of Law. Destiny, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me. I appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
I briefly mentioned Richard and Mildred Loving in their case. I think lots of people maybe have seen the documentary that came out this year about it. For people who haven't, what else can you tell us about their story?
I think it's important to emphasize that they really were just a regular couple. And a lot of big cases that end up at the Supreme Court, even landmark cases, don't start off as cases where
they're just normal people, right?
Right. They just think,
especially 50 years ago.
Exactly. They just think, we want to be married. We want to be lawfully married. We want our relationship to be legitimate in our home state, in the state that we love. And so when they started this process, they were really just trying to deal with wanting to be able to live in the state of Virginia, their home state, as a married couple. And it was only after the Civil Rights Act of 1964, when Mildred Loving, after news coverage, wrote to Attorney General Robert Kennedy at the time and said, is there anything you can do for us? She wasn't thinking about necessarily that this could change the landscape of laws in the entire country.
And not just laws, right? Because
exactly.
As we look at how much, before we get to the societal part, let me ask you a law question.
Sure.
What were the laws around interracial marriage during that time? Was it something that was just illegal in the South, or was this true across much of the United States?
So at the time that Loving was decided in 1967, there were 16 or 17 states, mostly or all southern states, that still had prohibitions against interracial marriage, including statutes that criminalized, meaning that people could go to jail for interracial marriage. In Virginia, they also had a statute against going to a state where it was legal to get married and coming back to Virginia. So 16 or 17 states at the time it was decided. There had been more states prior to that, but the civil rights movement had done some work to get rid of some of those statutes in other states.
And what did it mean that interracial marriage, it was a criminal, it wasn't a civil offense?
Right. And so criminal meant that they could be brought into court, and if
they could go to jail.
They could go to jail. And if you look at the legal history of these, they were called anti-miscegenation laws. If you look at the history of these laws, there was a continued ramping up over time of the punishments afforded to anyone who was found guilty of violating these Racial Integrity Acts. That was the name of the act in Virginia at the time, that were meant to bar these cross-racial relationships. So they started with smaller prison time or fines, and they eventually worked themselves up. The states worked themselves up to longer and longer prison sentences and increased fines.
So when this first case came up to lawyers in Virginia, was it immediately obvious to them that this could be a landmark case? It's always interesting to look back in hindsight, right?
I think so. I don't know the kind of full detailed history here, but basically after Mildred wrote to Attorney General Kennedy, he forwarded it to the American Civil Liberties Union, who forwarded it to affiliates that they had in Virginia. And seemingly those affiliates of the ACLU realized that there was something about this case that could make it a landmark case. But at the very initial stages of the Loving story, again, they were just trying to not be imprisoned for wanting to be married in the state of Virginia.
A white person and a black person who wanted to be married to each other. As is the case with a lot of Supreme Court cases, Destiny, the ruling isn't the end of the story, right? Because how did states respond to this ruling when it first came down?
So as we saw in the civil rights movement and with other cases, including the desegregation case Brown v. Board of Education, states did not immediately comply. And in fact, there were states that were resistant. And just like we saw very recently after the same-sex marriage case, it is guaranteed that there were local county clerks who issued marriage licenses that, despite the Supreme Court ruling, would refuse to issue marriage licenses. In fact, I think not that long ago, a few years ago, we had a county clerk who refused to issue a marriage license to, and I can't remember the details of that story, but someone who was white and a white black couple, in the 2000s, just a few years ago. And that's the difficulty with the Supreme Court decision, but there's a bunch of local officials who are the ones who have to enforce and adhere to the law. And only if you kind of get a lawsuit or something like that, can you make sure that the law is always being enforced?
Well, it's a really interesting question. And as a law professor, I'm curious your thoughts on the idea of legal precedent changing cultural attitudes, because that's precisely what you're talking about, right? The fact that this set a legal precedent, but obviously went against, for a lot of people, the prevailing cultural attitudes at the time.
And this is a big debate, actually, in law, at legal scholarship, in legal practice, about whether law leads the way in terms of changing social attitudes or whether social attitudes change and the law follows. Certainly in the civil rights movement, the law seemed to be leading the way and doing things ahead of people, society being ready to do it. And even after Loving, there was a fairly quick increase in the number of people who sought marriage licenses for their interracial relationships. And we've certainly seen over time, over decades now, a fairly large explosion in the number of couples who are interracial married couples.
And I wanted to ask you about that in a minute, because I know you've done research on psychological research on the perception, particularly of mixed race children in the U.S. Before we get to that, I'm just sort of curious what your parallels are as someone who, from an academic perspective, of the interracial marriage issue, and as you mentioned, the same-sex ruling that we've seen in America in the past couple of years, also with Supreme Court, with DOMA. Do you see that as is that a pretty equitable parallel? You're shaking your head yes.
Yes, yes. And it's certainly, if you read the opinions in the cases leading up to the same-sex marriage cases, so the cases that were handled by the appellate level, the different circuits across the U.S., and then eventually the Supreme Court, Loving played an incredibly important role in providing the precedent for the arguments that the Supreme Court ultimately decided Obergefell on. So Loving set the precedent for this argument, these arguments about equal protection, about the right to marry, and not kind of discriminating against people for wanting to marry other humans. This isn't a matter of kind of deviant or what most people these days consider deviant behavior. These are just people who love each other who want to get married, and states are interfering with that.
And so do you feel like, I wonder, culturally, it sounds like though we were at a different point with same-sex marriage now than, you're also nodding your head yes, than it was the Loving versus Virginia case was clearly a point where this was very taboo.
Yes. And the same-sex marriage, the development of those attitudes over time have been very accelerated compared to attitudes around race. So the public opinion around same-sex marriage has changed fairly rapidly.
It's changed very quickly. Right. Oh, so interesting. So from your perspective, do you think that's just a cultural thing as opposed to a legal precedent?
It's hard to say. This is why it remains a debate and has always been a debate, the extent to which the law is influencing or reflecting what's going on. And I think it's probably a little bit of both, that for sometimes judges, the Supreme Court, et cetera, are responding to attitudes they see out there. And at the same time, they're also influencing people.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Destiny Perry. She is an assistant professor at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court ruling Loving versus Virginia. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com. We'll be right back.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 50 years ago this week, the Supreme Court's ruling of Loving versus Virginia struck down state laws that criminalized interracial marriage. I'm talking about that with Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law Assistant Professor Destiny Peary. Destiny, you know, we were just talking about the whole idea of law versus cultural attitude. Mm-hmm. You've done a lot of psychological research on the perception of mixed-race children in America, which obviously has a lot to do with how mixed-race couples are seen. And I wonder, how much does that play also into changing cultural attitudes of mixed-race couples when we look at also the numbers of mixed-race children, multiracial, biracial children in the U.S.?
So interestingly, in the Loving case, one of the arguments made by Virginia was that there was concern about the children that would be produced. And Mildred and Richard had three children, that they would be, you know, and this is a kind of common story out there about mixed race kids, that they, you know, will be confused, that they won't fit in anywhere. We don't know how to categorize them, et cetera. And my research on the social psychology side of things shows people know perfectly well a lot of times how to categorize these folks. We have long histories of just categorizing them, especially as non-white in the U.S. But there is a lot of concern about, or and has traditionally been a lot of concern about, how these children who result from these interracial relationships will be able to negotiate their identities.
But it's interesting you say that, because I think while certainly there is that conversation about that, I have to think about my family, so much of my family is also mixed race. And the sort of the cultural comments about, you know, how beautiful they are because they reflect, you know, Indian and all of these, you know, other. So it's an interesting conversation. Yeah. Now I feel like that is also part of our.
So on the other side of that, there's a theory that's called hybrid vigor, which is about basically how the argument, the positive argument for mixed race kids, which is, you know, that they kind of get the best of both worlds. They're more beautiful. They have
the
all
best
these
and the worst, I guess.
Exactly.
Would probably how you would sum it up nowadays.
Basically, that there is this argument that they are, you know, that they are more beautiful. They are all, you know, they are lighter skinned. They're all of these things than a lot of times the minority groups that they come from. But there's still this kind of tragic mulatto story that exists there, too, that assumes that they're confused and they don't know, you know, where they fit in and things like that. So there is a kind of duality to being a mixed race person and how people view you, both in positive and negative light.
Yeah. So I guess you would say 50 years on, where do you think we're at now?
Well, there is a lot of discussion about how interracial marriage is increasing. So it's something like 16-17% of marriages now are interracial, according to a recent Pew report. And as you mentioned, the population changes, demographic changes. There's more and more mixed race children all of the time. And lots of people think this will solve our racial problems. I'm not in that camp. I don't think it will solve our racial problems. So there is this kind of hopeful narrative out there about how increasing interracial marriage and more multiracial children will fix our problems, but it certainly is much more complicated than that.
It's obviously much more complicated than that. We could spend a whole hour talking about that. You'll have to come back and we'll have to do that conversation. But I really want to thank Destiny Peary. She's an assistant professor at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law, for us just having a little moment here to remember what happened 50 years ago this week, landmark Supreme Court ruling of Loving versus Virginia. Destiny, thank you so much for being with
Thanks
me. I appreciate
for having
it.
Me.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's the time of year when people who suffer from seasonal allergies really have it bad. You know what I'm talking about if you're there. Runny noses, watery eyes, scratchy throats, endless sneezing and coughing. Seasonal allergies to pollen or other allergies in the air affect about 1 in 10 people. And while it may seem like allergies are merely a nuisance, studies have found that allergies can actually affect your brain's ability to function normally. I could have told you that. To help us learn more about this and offer advice to allergy sufferers, I'm joined now by Dr. Neha Dunn. She's an allergy and immunology specialist at OSF Healthcare in Peoria. Dr. Dunn, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So do you get the sense that people generally tend to think seasonal allergies aren't that big of a deal?
I think people who don't have seasonal allergies underappreciate the symptoms that people with allergies suffer. As you mentioned, people who have allergies can have significant reductions in the ability to think clearly and be productive at work. And if you don't have allergies, you might not be able to relate to this as well.
Yeah. So why do we know why that happens? Why can you explain a little bit of what goes into why would allergies give us sort of like a mental fogginess?
Absolutely. So for starters, people who have allergies often are symptomatic at night. Pollen is released first thing in the morning around 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and it can significantly reduce people's ability to sleep at night. When you're congested and you can't breathe out of your nose, especially for people who have allergies out there, you know that you can wake up either coughing or feeling like you can't breathe. And so getting restless sleep can affect people's ability to function clearly throughout the day. In addition to not getting restful sleep, many patients are on medications for their allergies, and certain medications like older antihistamines can cause people to feel sedated throughout the day.
Yeah, you know, I am one of those weird percent of the population where Claritin knocks me out. So I take, you know, so and
that's
like...
Absolutely. Even the newer medications that only affect a small percentage of people can cause sleepiness in certain populations. And so that in conjunction with not being able to sleep, and even when you're sick, you just can't think straight. Even if you just have a cold, sometimes people can relate to that more, where you're just fatigued and you feel like you have a headache and you're just not thinking clearly. And so people with allergies go through that for an entire season.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm talking to Dr. Neha Dunn. We're talking about cognitive function during allergy season, and it's because of a recent study that was done in Norway that found that students' test scores fall when pollen counts rise. There's been other studies in the UK and the US that have found similar things. Dr. Dunn, are adults affected differently than children?
That's a really good question. I don't think there's studies that have actually compared the effects between children and adults, but I will say I get many adult patients who feel very similar symptoms.
Just
to
as
what
miserable, right? Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And so they're at work, and when their allergies are severe, they just can't think straight. They're not functioning at 100%, and they complain to me about it all the time. And so similarly, patients' parents of kids also say, well, you know, I had to either take my kid out of school because their allergies were so bad, or which, of course, can lead to decreased test scores because you're missing school, or just feeling like their kids aren't 100% awake because of their medications again or decreased sleep.
And so let's talk about specifics, first of all. What are the best things to do this time of year? And I'm sorry, before we even get to that, what are we looking at this time of year? Why are May and June so tough?
Yeah, that's a great question. So specifically in Illinois, May and June are really tough because trees, grasses, and weeds are pollinating right now. So people who have allergies to all three are getting hit in three different directions. And so they have, their bodies are fighting off pollen exposure from several different plants out there.
And that said, what are the best tips for people to think about how to handle things this time of year?
Yeah, so one simple thing people can do is just close the windows. For people who like to get that fresh air or leave their windows open at night, and, you know, of course that's cheaper than using air conditioning, but if you leave the windows open, pollen is just blowing right through those windows into your home. And just by closing the windows when people are at home or especially in the bedrooms or driving can decrease pollen from entering the home. I mean, we usually are the ones that bring pollen into our home, whether it's on the bottom of your shoes or on your clothes. So I tell my patients, when you get home, take your shoes off. If you've been outside all day, change your clothes, take a shower. I tell people, even if they're not allergic to their pet, oftentimes animals are bringing pollen into the home. also keeping your animals out of your bedroom, which is your environment where you should be able to get some restful sleep, can prevent pollen from accumulating.
Right. Okay. So that's kind of practical things. Do you recommend what other things, like, are there air purifiers? I mean, I know there's like a whole sort of allergy industry of things that can help you. What kind of advice do you provide for people for that generally?
Great question. So air purifiers are a little bit controversial in my opinion. Patients can kind of go nuts with how much they spend on an air purifier, and studies haven't shown a significant difference in pollen counts in the home with or without using an air purifier. The one time it is really beneficial is if you have an animal allergy and you get a HEPA air filter, a high efficiency particle air filter. That has shown to some degree to decrease pollen levels in the home or dander levels in the home. But the main things that I think are helpful, and this is, again, based off of studies, is carpet removal. And that's because pollen and dander sticks to carpet. And you can vacuum it multiple times throughout the week, but it's really hard to get pollen or dander out of carpet versus hardwood floors. The other thing that is helpful are dust mite covers, actually, for your mattresses and your pillows. They can reduce dust mite levels in the home. Of course, this is more for people who have dust mite allergies, which are more year-round.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Dunn, any final advice for folks? When do they need to see someone like you?
That's a good question. So if you feel like your allergies aren't controlled with just over-the-counter medications, people who are having not only allergy symptoms, but allergies can affect asthma and eczema. So if some of those things are out of control, it's a good time to see an allergist to find out what you're allergic to and what additional therapies we can offer.
That's Dr. Neha Dunn. She's an allergy and immunology specialist at OSF Healthcare in Peoria, giving us, for those of us who do suffer from allergies, some practical advice for how to get through the next few weeks. Dr. Dunn, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All morning, we've been following the shooting in the Washington, D.C. area. Again, just to wrap up with the top story for today, a gunman opened fire at a GOP congressional baseball practice. Five people were shot, including House Majority Whip Steve Scalise. His office says he's in stable condition and out of surgery. Earlier this hour, we heard from 13th District Republican Rodney Davis, who was at practice, but he was not hurt physically. Republican Congressman John Shimkus represents Illinois' 15th congressional district. He also plays on the GOP baseball team. He wasn't at practice this morning. He released a statement earlier in the hour saying, "My prayers are with my good friend and D.C. roommate Steve Scalise, as well as the Capitol Police officers, member staff, and all those affected by today's shooting. While we don't fully know the motive behind this shameful act of evil, there is no doubt the heroism of the Capitol Police saved lives this morning." President Trump said last hour that the suspected shooter has died. NPR reports he's been identified as James T. Hodgkinson from Belleville, Illinois. Belleville, of course, just a little bit east of St. Louis. The New York Times is reporting that the suspect was an opponent of President Trump. According to his brother, he, quote, wasn't happy with the way things are going. A few minutes ago, Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders released a statement saying he's sickened by this despicable act. Sanders says he's learned the shooter apparently volunteered on his 2016 presidential campaign. I wanted to update you as well with one more Illinois Congressman, Darren LaHood, also has issued a statement. The 18th District Republican says he's relieved that his friend and colleague Steve Scalise is in stable condition. Of course, to echo the thoughts of Republican Rodney Davis, what he said earlier today, he said for him, this is a breaking point for America. He said this has to stop. The political rhetoric of hate in this country. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about this again on the 21st. My question to all of you listening, where do we go from here? If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our phone number is 217-300-2121. Again, that's 217-300-2121. Your thoughts on where we go from here as a country. If you want to email us, our email address is talk@21stshow. You can also send us a tweet. We've gotten a couple of those already. We're going to read some of those tomorrow. Our handle is 21stshow. That does it for us today. As always, you know, I mentioned our Twitter handle. We're continuing to follow this story. Follow us on 2NST Show throughout the day for developments. Stay tuned to this NPR story, this NPR station, which will be updating you. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from the Medill Newsroom in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.